I'm Jessica Paresta, host of the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast, a part of the Education Podcast Network. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Teaching While Queer is a podcast for 2S LGBTQ plus educational professionals to share their experiences in academia. Hi, I'm your host, Brian Stanton, a theater pedagogue and educator in New York City, and my goal is to share stories from around the world from 2S LGBTQ plus educators. I hope you enjoy Teaching While Queer. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Teaching While Queer. I am your host, Brian Stanton. My pronouns are he, they. And today I'm so excited because we are taking a trip to Glasgow. We are meeting with Damon Young. How's it going?
Hi, great. Yeah, and thank you for having me, Brian. Really nice to be here.
I'm so happy that you are able to join us. Can you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So, as Brian said, I'm Damon. I live in Glasgow, but I'm from Manchester in England. I currently work in a university in Glasgow called University of Strathclyde. I've been teaching there now since 2019, so just before the pandemic. Prior to that, I was abroad working in Italy and Taiwan, where I first started my teaching career, kind of with children and teenagers before moving into higher education.
Awesome. And how do you identify within the LGBTQ community?
So I am a cisgendered male gay man, but I would also identify as being part of a queer community. So, I recognize traits within myself that don't fit the social construct what a gay man should look like, anybody kind of, it's not binary, essentially. So yeah, I would identify as a gay man, but also as a queer person within the community.
Yep, absolutely. That's kind of how my journey has been as well. I currently identify as queer because I feel like it's most comfortable and I guess ambiguous enough to not put in a mold, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that, you know, through the research that I've been doing, I've kind of been learning about myself as well as I've been going, reading, you know, a lot of academic research, a lot of kind of personal anecdotes from people that have been published online. So, yeah, it's kind of a lot of them have kind of resonated with me and gone, oh, yeah, I kind of see myself there. And that's the realization of going, yeah, I'm a queer person and I'm happy to say that, proud to say it. And yeah, we'll say that to anybody who ever asks. In the past, I probably wouldn't have said that, but yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It's definitely, the word has had an evolution, and I think that it's now reaching a pinnacle of acceptance with and without the community.
Right, yeah. I think one of the things that kind of sticks out for me is, I don't know about yourself as well, being in the States, but in the UK, the term queer was definitely kind of a derogatory term that was used by, you know, cisgendered heterosexual people as an insult to gay, lesbian, trans people. But now I think, as you mentioned, we've kind of turned that corner where taking ownership of the word again is really great. And actually had a conversation with quite a few people in their, you know, 60s and 70s who would say, oh, so we can say that now? And is it okay for us to say that? And blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, if I tell you I'm queer and you're talking to somebody else, then yeah, you can just say that. Of course, if it's used in the right way, so I think it's about people from that generation also relearning that, you know, LGBTQIA plus or queer community have taken ownership again, which is great.
Yes, absolutely. And that evolution, I think, is so empowering. And also, I can see how it would be difficult for folks who maybe only heard it as a derogatory term. So it's interesting. It's kind of like, I don't know. There's a lot of people within the gay community who kind of reclaimed the word
faggots, and I'm not one yet to get myself there, but like I feel that they, you know, all the power to you for feeling confident in reclaiming that word. But I don't know, having been on the other end of it a couple of times in my life, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I can.
Absolutely. Yeah, Brian, I'm totally there with you. And I think I had a conversation recently over the holiday season, and, you know, the famous Pogue song, A Fairy Tale of New York, and the word faggot is used in that. And I had a conversation with somebody recently who kind of thought, I've really not thought about it too much and whether it does affect me or whether it does offend me. And actually I realised, it still does kind of affect me, because like you, being on the receiving end of that word used in, you know, a way to cause harm and to discriminate, etc. It is still quite triggering, I think. So I'm like you, Brian, I'm not quite there yet, but maybe one day I'll get there.
You know, it's funny because I had never heard that song until this year, and it's one of the most popular
really?
Songs. Yes, but I think it definitely has a bigger following in the UK than it does in the US, but I saw I saw a news article about it and about the word and how even the artists were like, you know, I think that we should remove the word. And in my brain, I'm going, well, you're the artist. Just go record it. You know, like, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. They did. They actually changed the lyrics. So I think now in the UK, you don't really hear that version unless you go on Spotify or whatever, or any other platform. Yeah. And then you hear it there, but you don't hear it on, like, you know, MTV or on the radio or anything, because I think they realize that it would cause more offense than not. So, and if the artist is saying it like you say, then I think it's, you know, we should take a lead from the artist, I guess. If they recognize that it can cause offense, then, you know, what's the harm in changing the word?
Absolutely. What a fun little trail that we just went down. But
I know.
Let's talk a little bit more about you. What was life for you like as a queer student, like as a youth?
So, yeah, I mean, growing up in Manchester, Manchester in the kind of mid to late 90s, there's Canal Street, which is famous kind of globally, I guess, for being a safe space for the queer community, LGBTQ plus people. You know, there are bars for all kind of people within the queer community. So I knew that growing up, because I remember that my auntie and my cousin, who's the same age as me, my auntie took me to my first Pride event in Manchester. And I remember being about 10, 11 years old going, my gosh, this is amazing. And looking at all the colours and going, and I think I had realised maybe a couple of years before that I was gay. And having seen kind of what my life would, you know, maybe look like in the future, maybe not dancing on a float or whatever, but kind of the message that it is empowering kind of meant a lot to me. So I really, that's a memory that always sticks in my mind. Because in high school, I think, although I had a really good kind of high school journey generally, I think I should also recognize that certain people did target me for homophobic abuse. So the word faggot was used. Also being called George Michael as an insult. And I thought, okay, you think that's an insult? I don't, but okay. It's these kind of memories that stick in your mind. And what is nice that's kind of come out of that is a couple of people from high school have reached out to me since via Facebook and apologized for the behavior, because I think they realized that, you know, they were just being sheep. And I guess, you know, the society that we were living in, kind of late 90s, early noughties, there was still a hangover effect of, in the UK, we had something called Section 28, which was about, in kind of the Thatcher years, no LGBTQ plus material in schools. You can't have any books. You can't, don't talk about it. No, you know, so I think that was a kind of hangover. And I was on the tail end of that going to school. So it was quite a pleasant experience in high school. And I think being part of this rock band. We weren't really a rock band. We were more like a cover band. So we'd cover songs, you know, from Tina Turner right through to Phil Collins. That kind of saved me. So in, I think I was about 12 years old. So in high school, you start at 11 in the UK. So at 12 years old, I joined the band as a singer, had to audition. I can't sing now, so please don't ask me to sing because I've lost my voice completely. But yeah, at the time, it was a really good experience. And I remained in the band throughout my high school years. And I don't know, I felt like everybody was different. And I was like, wow, everyone's really different in this band. And there were, you know, two keyboardists, a bass guitarist, drummer. At one point, there were five singers. And I remember thinking, oh, wow, they're totally different to the other people in my class. And I started to recognize the differences in people, whether they were gay or queer. And, you know, now I now know that some of those people that were in the band were actually gay as well. So we toured Europe and it felt like a really super safe bubble to be part of, because I'm pretty sure my music teacher recognized that I was gay as well. Just how kind of tentative he was, you know. I think he could see that I was quite soft, quite reserved, quite shy. But on stage, listen, I thought I was like Britney Spears or something, you know, getting on stage. But yeah, so that was a really safe space to be part of. So one of the other kind of memories that pops up, I guess, is in physical education. And I guess this is the same for most queer youths or LGBTQ plus youths, kind of going into the shower room. Now, in the UK in the 90s, most schools had communal showers still. So you would have to go and it'd be one kind of long shower, basically. And people would say to me, you know, oh, don't look at my penis, you know, and I'd be like, I'm not, like, don't flatter yourself, you know. And I think they were really trying to, you know, make me feel insignificant, you know, and at times it really did. And, you know, I would actually make up excuses for not having my sports kit to play soccer, because I just didn't want to get changed, because I just thought they're going to bully me again. They're going to say that to me. They know that I'm gay. I can see that. And then I got made to be referee. So I didn't know the rules for soccer. So I would just blow the whistle randomly and, yeah, people would shout at me. And anyway, so that was an absolute nightmare. It was like hell on earth, I think. And those kind of traumatic experiences, I think they stay with you, you know. And now when I go to the gym, even in Glasgow, there's still that kind of, oh, you know, that kind of tension of, oh, you know, please don't say anything to me, even though nobody is going to say anything, you know.
Absolutely.
But it still kind of niggles there in your mind. So yeah, it's been an interesting but mostly pleasant experience. I know that's not the same for most queer youths, but I know that a lot of young people, kind of from my generation, late 90s, early noughties, experienced pretty much the same as me, having spoken to friends my age and things. And yeah, it's traumatic. Now, I will say that I've been into a lot of schools when I was doing teacher training and all these different things and volunteering. And it's just incredible to see, you know, an Equality, Diversity, Inclusion board. And it's got information about Pride, and it's got the, you know, the progress flag, and it's got the trans flag, and it's got, you know, all of these, you know, Marsha P. Johnson on there in History Month that they were having. And I just thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I really wish I'd had this in school growing up, because, you know, when you leave school and you start to learn about yourself and you go to the university or whatever, you go to work, we don't know about our history, you know, the Pride movement in New York, you know, Stonewall movement, that we then learn about and go, wow, what bravery, you know. And I think had that been part of our history lessons, and, you know, it just would have been so empowering to be like, you know what, I can stand up and I can stick up for myself because these people did. They were fearless, and I kind of wish I had that, but, you know, now I do, which is great. So
yeah, absolutely. And there's something about it, like, where I think that as a community, we have not only like ancestral connections to like our own blood, but ancestral connections to our community. And so for me, I grew up around, like, we're about the same age, and I grew up kind of disconnected from the queer community. And now I'm like, oh, look at all these trailblazers who came before me. And I see how I'm connected to them and what that means for me as a person on how, what I want to blaze trails for going into the future.
Oh, 100%. And like you said, you kind of, they're like idols, you know? And I think I was talking to my therapist a couple of months ago about this, and there's a kind of shared experience through reading about the sufferings that a lot of the queer and LGBTQ plus community went through. And like you say, you know, it's when you learn about these things, it, I don't know about you, but it can be quite triggering as well, because you think, my gosh, we, you know, we're living in a world. I mean, the world isn't perfect still, and we've got a lot to do to get to a place where it is equitable and equality is, you know, existing completely. But it was a lot worse back then, you know. And I think just, you know, this word bravery just keeps coming to my mind because it really was brave, you know, the amount of not only physical, but mental trauma that a lot of people went through to stand up and say, I exist, I'm here, I'm not going anywhere. So, you know, deal with it, you know, and I just think it's incredible that these people stood up and we are, you know, benefits of those people standing up those 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes I will watch a documentary or I will read something and just like, it's almost completely triggered trauma for me because of the treatment of queer people before my time. And just like thinking about how that connects to me. And part of that is that I'm a very empathic person. I feel lots of things. But it's been interesting kind of like as I learn and grow the things that I didn't realize that maybe I was holding on to. And that they don't get unleashed until it's connected to some sort of like historical lesson about queer people from the past.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. I completely agree with you, Brian. And it is all about, and I think it's important that we, you know, we just never forget the kind of experiences that people in our shared history went through for us to be able to, you know, live the lives that we're living today. It is so important not to forget. So
absolutely,
which is why pride is even more important. You know,
it's funny because I a lot of people are kind of the mentality. Well, a lot of people I've encountered at least are on the mentality of like, pride is just a party now. It doesn't really mean anything. And so it was almost a blessing that like the anniversary of Stonewall, the 50 years, happened in 2019 to kind of remind people what it was for. And then, unfortunately, around the world, we've seen this kind of pushback on the queer community. Now it's even more important because we're again standing up and saying, you know, we're here. And we're not going away, and you're going to have to learn to live with that fact.
Yeah, it's interesting because the first thing it makes me think of there is me and my partner both got a job in Glasgow after having decided to move back from Italy back to the UK. And we both managed to get jobs in Glasgow, which was great. And I'm really glad that we did. Not to say that I wouldn't want to live in Manchester or England, because Manchester is a very liberal city. It's, you know, very left-leaning. It's very forward-thinking. You know, the suffragettes movement started in Manchester. So it's always had that kind of mentality of, hang on, this is oppression. We won't stand for it. So I'm not saying that I wouldn't want to live in England, but Scotland and the Scottish government seem to have a different direction to the English government, which is also the UK government. So Scotland tried to pass laws for the Gender Recognition Act to make it easier for trans people to self-identify, but the English or UK government blocked it in the Supreme Court. So it's this kind of, you know, push and pull from even with internal within the UK that just seems really unfair. And I know that's a totally different subject to do with independence in Scotland. However, it just makes me think that the injustices that exist because of governments and because of laws and just general oppression. And like you say, kind of going backwards, a lot of governments. I know that in Europe, the right and even the far right has risen in a lot of countries, and a lot of far right parties have been winning recently, which is, again, quite worrying, because generally the far right, as we know, are, they don't like us, do they? So,
yeah. It's interesting because prior to moving to New York City, I lived in Texas for 5 years. Texas is very conservative, far right. And and my description of it is that Texas is anti-people. Is how I feel about the far right movement, is that while they have this veneer of like, we're doing this for family values and all this stuff, but they don't actually care about their constituents. They don't care about any people but the people in power. And so my concern is, and this is where I see kind of a lack of humanity across the board, like around the world, we're seeing this lack of humanity, and it's coming from these pushback of the far right community, because I very much believe that they are not for people, period. They are for control and power. And that's a generalization. And I am not a political scientist, so, you know, disclaimer, but these are my observations that, as an educated person who's experienced living in, you know, liberal spaces and living in very conservative spaces, this is what I see there, that, you know, businesses have more power than people in the conservative spaces.
Yeah.
The government has more power than people in the conservative spaces, while also at the same time saying the government needs to be out of our, you know, get out of my house, but then the government wants to be in my house. So it's a it's a contradictory thing where it just really feels like we are losing our humanity due to this kind of like politicizing of things.
So I couldn't agree more with you on every point.
Yeah, it's a wild time. I when I email guests, for those of you who are listening, you know, may not realize like the back end stuff that happens, but when I email guests about things, I always include a line that's like, we are living in turbulent times, so if you need supports on X, Y, and Z, you know, reach out to me. And like, that's really what it feels like. It feels like at any moment, you know, you're flying your plane, which is your life, and at any moment it's gonna drop 10 feet because something wild has happened.
It totally does feel like that. It's to be living in that space constantly as well is also quite challenging. It's exhausting, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you totally understand. Yeah.
So how do you think I would agree with you in the sense that like late 90s, early aughts, like it was easier. I feel like I didn't have a hard time either in my high school years. I had, you know, a couple of bullies, a couple of instances like you're talking about in, you know, the gym. And so I still have issues at the gym because of that. So I'm with you there. But how do you think your experience have kind of influenced your work in education?
How has it influenced my work? Well, massively, actually, because I mean, to be honest, I was a little bit, when me and my partner first decided to go to Taiwan, it was kind of on a whim. We both just graduated from our undergraduate degrees, and we thought, let's go and explore somewhere else. So we did that, and then we thought, oh, we could turn this into a career. So it was teaching English in Taiwan, And then we got a qualification and we moved to Sicily, where we stayed for 3 years. And I'd never in Taiwan didn't receive any kind of homophobic abuse or anything like that. Now in Sicily, we did get into an incident whereby these Sicilian guys, we were switching between Italian and English speaking with some friends, and these guys overheard us and called my partner a faggot. So then it ended up being a fight. Police were called, ambulance, they broke my nose, they broke my partner's nose. And I was just like, I can't deal with this anymore, I can't take it. And that was in 2018. Yeah, 2018. Early 2018. So we decided, maybe that was part of the reason why we decided to come back to the UK as well. Sicily was generally very open, but you know, it was also a place where I wouldn't feel comfortable walking down the street holding hands with my partner, just because you would be targeted. That was how I felt. And so when we moved to Glasgow, I got the opportunity, whilst we were teaching, I teach now academic English to international students at the university I work at. And I got the opportunity to start my doctorate. So I thought, okay, what do I want to look at here? What do I keep coming back to? And I had a conversation with a few people at the university, and it kept coming back to EDI. And I thought, okay, yeah, this is something that I could see myself doing long term. I could see myself working within EDI in some capacity. I could see myself, you know, looking at the law, looking at these policies. Are they working? Why are they not working? Et cetera, et cetera. So I did that as part of my research. I went to some universities around Scotland, and I interviewed the equality leaders of the universities and asked them, okay, from your perspective, what's working? What are the barriers, et cetera? And yeah, the results, I'm just about to finish. So I can't talk about the results yet, but I'm just about to finish my doctorate in the next kind of 5 months, I hope, fingers crossed. And yeah, I would say that my life experiences of going into kind of into education are pushing me now more towards EDI. That's not to say that I don't love teaching, but you know, maybe I'd love to teach on some kind of equalities or equity course. But I definitely see myself going into maybe education establishments, like, you know, elementary schools, high schools, and saying, okay, this is what your policy looks like. This is what the law says. How are you going beyond that to make sure that your, you know, your LGBTQIA plus students are safe and they do feel like they can come to you, etc. Unfortunately, a law has just come into place in England whereby if a student, so an under 16-year-old, tells a member of staff their preferred pronouns, they have to inform their parents now, which I just think is devastating because, you know, I remember having teachers in school where I felt comfortable going to talk to them, and I always felt safe. Now that this is in place, the teacher may think, gosh, if that gets out, I could get into trouble, I could lose my job, etc. So it puts them in a really precarious position, and I think it's really unfair. So the reason I'm going into, you know, EDI, and that's what kind of led me into higher education, EDI specifically, is that, you know, we just spoke about the world changing, or it feels like there's a pushback about equality in many different areas of the world, and that's one of the things that kind of is pushing me towards it. I also had about 2 months ago, I was on some public transport and this guy was using his phone and sending voice notes to somebody and screaming down the phone, again, it's this word, you faggot this, faggot that, da, 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 da. And so I approached him and I said, listen, could you not use that word? And he completely flipped on me. This is a free country. I can say what I want. Who are you to tell me? Sit the fuck down. And I thought, what the hell? Everyone around me kind of just stood there, didn't say anything. And I was like, right, I could call the police, but you know what? I just felt the police aren't going to do anything. So anyway, long and short of it is I went into education because of those experiences and because I think I want to be able to help people. And that's first and foremost where my head's always at. How can I help them? What can I do to facilitate that? And how can I make the world a bit more of an equitable place to be for people like us and for people trans youth, non-binary, you know, how can we make it even better for them? And that's where my head is.
That is also fascinating because I was quite literally in a conversation with a friend from high school yesterday about EDI in the US. The acronym has changed around to DEI, but and we were talking about like policy versus law and the fact that you're talking about going into institutions and being like, okay, well, this is what the law says, but couldn't your policy be better? And that is where I'm going. Yes, it could. And we should all be able to blatantly say to lawmakers, like, yeah, here's the letter of the law, but we're doing this. We're in line with the law, but we're actually a step ahead. Because I think that lawmakers need to hear it.
Yeah, totally. And one of the things that I did was as part of my research, I looked at the policies, the EDI, but more specifically the LGBTQI plus and trans individual policies and non-binary policies that the universities, as part of my research in Scotland. And I analysed them and I kind of looked at the law to see, okay, are they doing just the bare minimum to kind of go, okay, tick box, performative exercise, or are they going beyond that? And now the Equality Act in the UK came in 2010, and I think there was an amendment in 2012 in Scotland, and that protects 7 characteristics. Now, when I looked at the Equality Act and I looked at kind of pre-Equality Act, actually, and I looked at what policies existed pre-Equality Act, only one of the universities that I looked at, and I looked at 4 universities, 4 big universities in Scotland, only one of them had an LGBTQ plus policy that was talking about protections and, you know, what's available, etc., and how people should be treated. The others just had kind of general equality policies. But then when the law came in, they changed it. And, you know, I have to say that they've gotten better, but some of them are still so vague that, you know, the law itself is very vague and can be, you know, misinterpreted by different universities. And I think, well, that university is doing this, but that university is doing that. Okay, have they looked at the local culture and the needs of the university? And that's why they've adapted the policy, or have they not looked at it? It's been a real kind of journey of, you know, moments of going, but how can you interpret, you know, this as that? And how's that university interpreted it in this way? And I'm not saying there needs to be a standardized way of understanding the law, because I do think that, you know, different universities have different cultures, and I think it needs to be looked at. For example, if there are more trans individuals going to one university, then the policy needs to reflect that, and I think it should be updated regularly to reflect the local population of the university. But that's not happening, so that's where for me in lies the problem. And I think, you know, equality impact assessments, or EIAs, are what a lot of universities are now adopting and employing to kind of put that as part of every part of the university experience. So, and it should be adopted in every part, so part of the curriculum. How can we look back at, you know, what's been taught over the past 10 years in, you know, a chemistry department, and how can we make sure that that is inclusive and representative in what we say, how we say it, etc. That's just one example, but yeah, it's there's a lot to do. Even though it is better, there's still a lot to do.
Absolutely. And I think one of the biggest things that any government can do at the moment is that I think that queer people and all of our categories need to be included in data, because for instance, the 2020 census in the United States was set up by President Obama to include, you know, the lesbian, gays for everybody, transgender folks and whatnot, and then was changed by Trump to only allow for those people who are married to say that they're in a same-sex relationship. So if you are married and your partner was same-sex, it like really held to the binary, and it only counted those people who were married. And so that, I think, is incredibly frustrating, because as much as I don't want to be a number on a page, I think that we need to have our data available, because people think that we are a very small portion of the world, and I'm kind of inclined to believe that we are much bigger than people think. We just don't have
absolutely.
The capacity. We don't have the capacity to get realistic numbers.
That's it. And this is something... Sorry, go on, Brian.
Oh, there was a TikTok I watched recently of a woman who found some data somewhere about the U.S. population of queer people, and was like, if we put them... all the queer people in one state, we would be the fifth largest state in the United States. And I think that's incredibly powerful.
Wow. Like,
and that's the kind of data that, one, I want to be able to cross-reference, right? Because I'm not going to rely on TikTok to tell me something.
Yeah, yeah.
And two, it's like, if we had that data available, it is a lot easier for us to combat some of the problems that we're facing. Because if people think that we're one in a million versus like one in three, then we are going to continue to face adversity. And the biggest message that I've seen is you are alone in this experience. And this idea that cisgender heterosexual community wants to make queer people feel like they're the only ones.
Yeah. And I think speaking about censuses, this census in the UK, the census, I think it was the 2021 England and Wales census, where it was the first time that they had included gay, lesbian, trans, etc. On the census. So now there is data that shows, you know, where there are high numbers of trans people living or high numbers of gay men living, etc. But in terms of universities, I think an education establishments, I don't think that data is recorded in a way that is representative. So where, for example, at one of the universities that I interviewed, they had 1.2 FTE, so over three people, working in the equality department, because the university thought, oh, well, that's fine, that'll suffice, that's kind of what our data shows, etc. But then a lot of people don't fill out that data. It's not mandatory. A lot of people may not be out, so don't consider that, you know. So then all the funds that should be available don't go to the areas that are needed. And also, now that academic capitalism has taken a hold in the UK, it doesn't bring in universities money. So a lot of universities may argue, oh, well, it doesn't reflect the needs of a local market, late labour market. So I guess they're kind of thinking, how can we, you know, stay above the rest, and having all these league tables and fighting for funding and things really kind of pushes EDI stuff to the side quite a lot. It's clear to see. However, on the flip side of that, I would say that a lot of universities, also in the UK anyway, do put a lot of money into EDI and queer and LGBTQI+ areas, because they want and they recognise that the community is larger, as you mentioned, than is kind of thought. So then they think, okay, well, we can get the what they call the so-called pink pound, right? And we can get their money through tuition and we can get them to come here. I'm just the research that I've been doing recently about academic capitalism kind of has me a bit skeptical about universities that do that, because some of them, as we mentioned, are just kind of performative tick box exercises that perhaps aren't as true as they seem. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've never heard that term ping pong, but I kind of like, I understand it and I kind of love it a little bit. I agree with you that I've had experiences throughout my life in different settings where it's like, I'm checking this box so I can get a check. And that happens a lot in academia. Like I work a lot on inclusivity for folks with disabilities through the work that I do in my studies. And I found that there is a high percentage of people who get put into disability services for the sake of the fact that states will give you extra money per student. But then the services that the students are receiving are not equitable to the amount of money that the schools are given, you know? So I want to check this box so that I can get the money, but I don't want to use that money for checking the box.
Yeah. Wow. It's just a conundrum, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, it really is. It's going to take some real systemic changes and ideally getting the capitalism out of education that is going to make some changes.
Yeah, that's going to be a whole, you know, lifetime of, yeah.
It's like earth shattering almost.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. No, so, it's just my.
Thinking about the turbulent times we're living in, what advice would you give to a new teacher who's going into the classroom and they're not sure whether or not they should be their authentic self?
It is a tricky question, because I think, you know, you want to say, well, we always live in hope and we always want people to, you know, be their true selves, be their authentic selves, go into the classroom, because why shouldn't you? And I think it's important that people do that, of course. I also think it's important that people recognize the kind of support and help that is available to them. So, you know, for people that perhaps are not comfortable coming out or recognizing that actually they're a trans individual or non-binary or whatever it is, as you mentioned earlier, there are people out there like you. So I think that's kind of one of the things. Brian, can you repeat the question for me? Sorry, I feel like I've gone completely off.
Absolutely. So if you've got a new queer teacher, they're heading into the classroom for the first time, and they are unsure about being authentic in the classroom and like maybe being out or being themselves fully, what advice would you give them?
Okay, yeah. Well, it makes me think about, again, in Taiwan and Italy, initially, me and my partner, because we both were teachers there, so it was very difficult to, even if we wanted to, hide the fact that we were together. From the very beginning, when we arrived and we were greeted by the school manager and they had accommodation for us and things in a hotel whilst we got apartments set up and things, she said, okay, Damon, here's your key. Okay, Richard, here's your key. And we both kind of got into the lift, went to our rooms and went, hang on, what are we doing? You know, we'd been together for just over 3 years at that point and thought, why have we just done that? We just kind of followed that. But we had told them prior to going there that we're together. So I thought, no, this is wrong. And you know, homosexuality in Taiwan and being gay, lesbian, whatever, is recognized in Taiwan and actually supported. And I think a couple of years ago, maybe it was last year, I can't remember, that same-sex marriage was legalized in Taiwan, which is great. So yeah, we went back downstairs and said, actually, we're together. And she went, oh, yeah, okay, of course, sorry, yeah, okay, which room do you want? And it was kind of like, at that moment, I was like, okay. Because it was a culture that we were both unfamiliar with, so at that moment, it was kind of, oh, right. And then when we were working together in fact, our classrooms were opposite, you know, all the teaching assistant staff and the other teachers knew we were together, the parents knew, pretty sure the teenagers and the kids knew in the school. So that was the kind of first experience for me of being out in a school in a different culture. I'd never done it in the UK because I was only volunteering and doing kind of placements as part of my undergraduate degree. So I guess looking back, there was never really an opportunity to talk about it. It certainly didn't come up in any lessons that I was observing as part of kind of teacher training and things, because I probably wouldn't have spoken about it then because I really didn't feel comfortable enough or confident enough to be my authentic self, I guess. I guess I was young and wouldn't really know or didn't really know how to handle it. So that first experience in Taiwan for me was okay, this is okay, and that's how you do it, and that's how you assert yourself in those situations, and you be yourself, and that's it. I am here, that's who I am. Great. If you don't like it, I don't really care. So then in Sicily, again, me and my partner, we were moving to Italy. He's Scottish Italian, so we both were like, let's move to Italy, and we both applied for all these schools all over Italy, and we ended up both getting jobs, coincidentally, at the same school in Catania, which again was like, my gosh, if there is something out there, how has this even worked out that there are two jobs, the same jobs? And it turns out that, I mean, everyone in the school, they're now like my best friends, you know, having worked there for 3 years, working with somebody from Hawaii, somebody from York, from Sicily, but from all over the place, you know, and very welcoming, not a problem. And some of the Sicilian friends that we made through some of our other Sicilian friends who had never really experienced being around gay people before were curious, and they asked questions, and I was happy to answer them, you know, because I think if you've never experienced being around gay people, or you think you've never experienced being around gay people, then yeah, I'm happy to sit down, have these conversations, and it was fine, and we're still all really good friends, and I'm happy that they did that. So I think going into education now, as I did, I think walking through those doors, you have to make a decision because you're on display and there are going to be other queer kids in that classroom or lecture theatre or whatever, and you're going to be that someone's light, you know, to say, yeah, I am here. Visibility is important. So wearing the progress flag, you know, I have the pride lanyard, the progress flag lanyard, and I wear every single day when I'm on campus. And, you know, a lot of my heterosexual colleagues wear it and stuff, which is great as well because it shows allyship. And I think having that visibility to say, yeah, we're an accepting university, it's great, etc., I think is fundamental. So, but I would only say that if you feel confident or comfortable enough at the very beginning to do that, you know, take your time, there's no rush. We're all different people, we're all individual. And I think it's about recognizing when the time is right for you. Because, you know, as we know, unfortunately, children, teens, or even adults can pick on or pick up on your kind of vulnerabilities, right? And mess with you, and yeah, it could work out to your disadvantage in that way. So make sure you're ready, make sure you're comfortable, make sure you're feeling confident with it. But remember that you being visible is also helping others in that room. Even if you don't know it, in the future, they'll think about you like, you know, I do. And I'm sure you do too, Brian. But yeah, that's kind of based on my experience and what I think now kind of merged together, I guess.
Absolutely. I think there was a part of your story that I really appreciate, which is that you don't have to necessarily make a huge deal out of your identity. You could just go about living your life and people will pick up on it. Just be yourself, you know?
And I'm just going to say, it's also, you probably recognize this as well, because there's a constant it's not a battle, but it is tiring constantly coming out to new people you meet, constantly, you know, going to a hotel with your partner. Oh, you know, it's a double bed. Yeah, I do know it's a double bed because we're partners, we're together. You know, it's situations like that on the phone.
Yep.
When I say, oh, my partner's not here at the moment, but I'll confirm with you later. Oh, what time is she home? And I think, come on, you know, train people better, you know. And that's what makes me think about working in EDI, because I really want to, you know, even if it's going into private companies like hotel chains, whatever, to say, this is how you should be, you know, addressing people. If they say my partner, you should refer back to partner as well, not, you know, you assuming pronouns unless they tell you about the pronouns, then okay, great. You know, these things. Sorry, I'm going on a tangent there.
No, but, absolutely. Yeah. I'm here for that. I am tired of that as well. And I think that's something that, you know, heterosexual people don't have to worry about. They don't have to worry about constantly coming out. And it's something that we have to deal with all the time, because I have the same situation. Like, unless I exclusively use the word husband, and even then I'll use that word and people will still be like, okay, well, let me know when she, and I'm like, no, like, what the heck?
I said husband.
Right. So, I appreciate that, because I think you're absolutely correct. It's exhausting because it's constant. So without diving too much, because this, I think this last question is borderline close to your, you know, experience in your doctorate.
Yeah.
So without diving too much into your own research, what do you think that the academic community can do to be more inclusive of 2S LGBTQIA plus people?
What can the academic community do? I think this question for me kind of takes me to two places, and I think education is a starting point of where people start to see different people, recognize differences, and listen to others and learn from one another, kind of peer teaching each other within an education establishment, for me is always really important. And I think in school and at home, I think the academic community, I guess, could encourage parents, if it's in high school and you have a kind of parents evening or parents meeting, and even giving out information to the parents who may not have been educated about the use of pronouns, for instance, or what non-binary people may look like, for instance. And I think having people educate parents who would, you know, hopefully in turn then speak to their children as well, would be something that I think would work, or should work, should just be part of encouragement, right? I think that encouraging students to stand up for themselves as well is also important. And I would hope that, you know, educators and academics and academic community would be in a position where they are constantly encouraging people to stand up. I think that's probably the most accurate answer I could give you.
Absolutely. At this point in the episode, I turn it over to you to ask me a question. So take it away.
Yeah, I mean, so this is season two, right? The start of season two. Yeah. What made you initially want to start this podcast? And what do you hope will come out of running this podcast for the queer community within the teaching field?
Yeah. So when I was living in Texas, I had the privilege of being nominated and then selected as the Teacher of the Year for my district in a relatively conservative district. And what's wild for me is that, thank you. What's wild for me is that, you know, I teach theater. And so my experience is theatrical and whatnot. And what I was doing was focusing on inclusivity. And so, like, what a powerful message, right?
That right.
you get selected because of your work on inclusivity. And that spanned several things. Like, I was involved in projects on the campus that were about, like, creating bridges to other communities. The school had a reputation of being in a bubble. And so, like, I created with some students a weekly TV show called Beyond the Bubble, where they, you know, expand your horizons, kind of. And so I was doing all of this work. And throughout my time at that school, from the very first month of working there, I had dealt with some, like, anti-queer behavior. And had seen, like, administrators come and go for various reasons. But every time we got a new administrator, it was like I was dealing with a new person who had some sort of quote-unquote microaggressions towards queer people. Right. And when I got Teacher of the Year, I basically had dealt with a bunch of experiences and then found out that there were, like, private meetings, or not necessarily private meetings, but meetings of, like, school board members and school board member candidates who were basically running on the "we're going to get the queer out of the school" campaign. And I have children, and so my children went to those schools, and it was a lot. And I was looking around for places to, like, connect with other people that had similar stories. And in the news, like, monthly at the time, you could find some story of a queer Teacher of the Year being fired or leaving a school district in the United States. But it was all in the news. There was, like, no connection. So after a year of thinking about it, I decided to start the podcast. And I started it in 2022, did the first season. We're in the middle of season two right now when this is being recorded, and this episode will actually air towards the end of it. And so I wanted to provide a space where people can share their experiences, because right now in the US, as well as other places around the world, queer teachers are experiencing this "you should not be queer" in educational spaces. We shouldn't have to know that you're queer. You shouldn't be allowed to talk about being queer. You shouldn't have your partner's picture up. You shouldn't, you know, live your life as a queer person, because children are just too young to know about queerness. But, like, I knew I was queer when I was four, so give me a break.
Well, exactly.
And so, I wanted to create a space for people to be able to share their stories. And the evolution of that is that in January of 2024, so just, you know, a week or two ago when this episode was recorded, I launched an online community where people can connect through, like, discussion boards. And I've got, like, monthly challenges on there. Like, the first month is, you know, meet someone new and try to connect with someone new. But the goal is to combat that feeling of you are alone in this experience, because you're not. And that's the thing that's so frustrating to me, is how effective the messaging is that you are alone. And while there are plenty of resources available for queer students and organizations focused on queer students, there are very few focused on queer educators and supporting those educators. And so my goal is to grow this podcast into a podcast that is a part of a nonprofit organization with the goal of supporting queer educators in whatever their needs are, with grant opportunities for, you know, extra training on things, or to bring a guest speaker to their school, or whatever they need to do. But my goal is to be there to create a community that supports queer educators, because we aren't alone, and there is power in our connecting to each other. And the more that we do that, the 100%. More that we're able to raise our voice and push back on everything.
Well, Brian, I mean, thank you for creating it, because honestly, I think from a personal perspective, it's really cathartic kind of looking at these things and discussing it and realizing the importance and realizing we're not alone. And like you said, being able to connect with people, you know, now we've connected, and I think that it's just a really wonderful thing to be able to, as you said, have this space to talk about it and realize we've had some similar experiences and okay, there's more of us, you know? So yeah, thank you for creating it, because I think what you're doing is absolutely needed. And like you said, the focus is on students. Great, that's wonderful. I'm glad there's a focus on students. But what about the educators? So yeah, thank you for creating the space for queer educators as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It honestly is a pleasure, mostly because in creating this community, I gain from the community. And I've, you know, had conversations with 40 different people from around the world, and it's so far, and it's been really nice, because then I'll think of something and share it with that person, because now I have this network of people to talk to about specific things. And so it's been just as rewarding as it has been work. But that being said, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. For those of you, a lot of people don't know behind the scenes stuff, this was literally just me sending him a message on LinkedIn and being like, hey, I saw you post in this queer educators group. Do you want to be on this podcast? And like, here we are. That's part of my love of the internet, but I also grew up, you know, during the internet being constructed. So that's.
So
thank you for joining me today. And then thank you all at home for listening. Have a great day.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Teaching While Queer. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Leave a review, and that would help out tremendously. You can also support the podcast by going to www.teachingwhilequeer.com and hit support the show. Thanks so much, and have a great day.